Will there be a bumper?
No, we don't. We have a little music bumper at the beginning, but...
But I don't get to hear it?
No, you don't get to hear it. Sorry, we're not that technical yet.
You can next Monday.
I can hear it.
The flyover effect with Dan Shipman.
This is a real top-notch thing you guys got going here. Way to go, guys.
High quality. It's Des Moines. You said so. All right, Dan, let's get ready to do this thing. In right. 5, 4, 3...
Two.
I knew that was going to happen. I knew you were going to choke.
I was counting. What the hell? Come on, guys. Hi, we're here with these two guys from Des Moines. I'm Russ Unger. Welcome to the Flyover Podcast Show.
Thanks for having us, Russ. I appreciate it.
Not a problem. Hopefully I didn't just blow your levels. How about that bumper music, folks?
Very sophisticated setup that you're working with, Russ.
Dear Lord, I hope this is the outtake reel.
Hi, I'm Dan Shipton, CEO of BitMethod and your host for The Flyover Effect, like Russ, our guest, just mentioned. Today I've got Scott Kuby, our Senior Product Director, here with me.
Hello, everyone.
And Russ Unger from HappyCog.
Hi there.
You are the User Experience Director at HappyCog, correct?
I am a User Experience Director. There is another one, Mr. Kevin Hoffman, who works out of our Philadelphia office.
You're also author, speaker, pimp, like everything, right?
Let's not go there with the pimp thing, but I've been very fortunate enough to co-author a couple of books with some great people, Carolyn Chandler on a project guide to UX design, which we've just been asked to do a second edition of, and currently writing Guerrilla UX Research Methods with Todd Zaki Warfel, who has a company called Message First in Philadelphia, and he also has a startup that's called, or a product called Reframer for doing some research with. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that. See, guys, I told you I don't want to sell me. I'm just going to sell other people. I get it. Pimp. See?
Yeah.
Got it.
So we're both from flyover country. As you say, you're in layover country over in Chicago. Nobody stops in Des Moines. They really just fly over us. But
I'll be in Des Moines this weekend, fellas.
Will you? Let's get together.
Absolutely.
Have a beer.
I can do that.
Awesome. Well, I'll connect after the show.
All right.
But you've done a number of things. How do you start building that empire in the middle of America?
So I think first that the word empire is a bit strong. thank you, though. You make me feel very HBO.
I'm prone to hyperbole, and Dan's been picking up on it. So
that's outstanding. So I think there's... It's interesting. When I'm just back from Portugal, and I was at UX Lisbon. I gave a workshop on guerrilla research methods. What a fantastic conference! What a beautiful city. Turned it into a bit of a vacation as well. But while I was there, I was having a conversation with a young man, Cyril, I think is his name, and I explained to him when I got my start, which I attended my very first conference in 2008, and it was the Information Architecture Summit in Miami. So if we're all doing the math, it means that I actually didn't have a real speaking gig in this industry and stuff until early 2009. So here we are in 2011. That means that I've really only been doing this as far as like the speaking and writing stuff goes for a couple of years, which I think people kind of go, wait, haven't you been around longer than that? And the answer is, sure, I've been on mailing lists and I've done other things.
Lurking.
Yeah, kind of. And hopefully trying to ask and answer intelligent questions. When I left that Information Architecture Summit, I had had the you meet all these people you've heard of. I mean, it's the first time I ever met Todd Zaki Warfel, who is my, who was Todd Warfel then, and who is now my co-author. I got to meet Lou Rosenfeld, and sat down and learned what he was doing with his book publishing company. So I kind of left there pretty well inspired and a little fired up because the Information Architecture Summit generally has, from what I understand, 50 to 60% or more new attendees each year. And the topics that were there made me feel pretty good about myself, at least from a self-assessing and measuring perspective of what my level was in the field.
Were you with HappyCog at that point?
Oh, gosh.
No. Okay.
No. I was working in the ad industry, and it was an interesting time. What was the biggest thing about this was I noticed that a lot of the content wasn't really targeted for first-time attendees in my perspective. Now, granted, I was a first-time attendee, so frankly, I really didn't know jack as to what to expect and stuff like that. And since then, I've done my best to learn about, you know, these conferences. I worked on the IDEA conference a few years in a row with some really talented people and learned a lot about how naive I was. And every time I attend a conference, I say, oh, there's something we could have done better. I was all fired up from the IA Summit and put together this outline of topics that I thought would be useful for new folks to kind of learn. And I reached out to Carolyn Chandler, who's been a friend of mine for a decade or more. And she started giving me feedback on this outline. And I said, rightfully so to her, wow, you should really write, you know, half of this, because there's some things that I don't think I have as much strength in that you do, and that you, it would offer a lot to this book. So we went through that, and with a little assistance and talking to a number of publishers, I was fortunate enough to know Christina Woodkey, and she put me in touch with Michael Nolan at Peach Pit, who worked with us a little bit. And the next thing you know, Carol and I were writing this book, and it's fortunately been pretty well received. So
all that time you were in the ad world while you were writing it?
Yeah, for the most part, pretty much ad world. But when I say ad world, it was the interactive portion of it. I'd been a contractor for a number of years. I'd worked for a mobile device company and all of that good stuff. So anyway, that's where the empire.
Talk to me about Momentum, because, you know, from that conference, the IA Summit in Miami, you know, it seems that once you got rolling, if, you know, you look at your list of speaking engagements and conferences and publishing work, it hasn't slowed down very much. Has that been difficult to maintain?
Yes and no. It depends on who you ask. So when we wrote the first book, I had a newborn in the house, which, by the way, kind of a dumb thing to do. I really thought that would be okay. And I was wrong. I spent a lot of time not sleeping. And I also spent a majority of the time, I had like 2 to 3 weeks off at a Christmas break because I'd earned some vacation time and stuff. So I sat home and essentially wrote my ass off and learned how to work really well with my editor, Linda, who had a amazing red pen and makes it look like I write well and don't do a lot of run-on sentences. But for me, the key has kind of been learning how to not multitask.
What does that mean?
So Steven Anderson, he does a lot of stuff on seductive interactions, and he and I have been doing a couple of workshops on critical thinking for UX designers or anyone. And he introduced me to a book by a gentleman who David Rock. The book is called Your Brain at Work, and it talks about how this is one of those almost new age thinking things that I generally don't tell my family that I read, because then I'm afraid that they'll think I'm in a cult. Well, hey, we're all Midwesterners here, right? It really just tells you about how much capacity kind of your brain has, and it's really just taught me a lot about, oh, these are the reasons that I've done things like write down lists. In fact, Merlin Mann has a great article on pencil and paper. You know, it's, I write something down and then I do something about it. So essentially I start every day with writing a list, and I get all of that clutter out of my brain so I can think on one thing at a time and move through the day, hopefully as fresh as I can and giving everything as much attention as it deserves. That new age thinking stuff aside, you know, a lot of it comes down to not sleeping a lot, which I'm getting better at. And it also comes... you know, there's just opportunities to do things. There's something called the Cranky Talk Workshop that I'm a part of, and we do this to help people who are new speakers or new presenters and who want to, you know, kind of attend conferences and start speaking themselves. I'm the new guy who's in that group. I'm the youngest one. So it seems like I've learned something. The best thing I can do is give it away. I mean, I feel like I'm obligated to do that and share with people things that I've learned or my failures, so that I can, you know, kind of teach that to people. Lord knows I've had plenty of failures and I've screwed up plenty. But at the same time, I also feel that a rising tide raises all ships. So if I can give away everything I have on these specific topics, then I can go find a new one and let someone else explore and do better things than whatever I was working on or something, or thinking about before.
Would you say it's fair that you have a focus from an educational speaking writing perspective on beginners, on helping people that are getting started?
I would say that I definitely focus in the beginning to intermediate areas. I like plain English. I like the I like breaking things down to really simple things, concepts and stuff, and letting people grasp that and moving on and learning on their own. Hell, I have a hard time with the advanced stuff. Big words are, you know, they're expensive.
What did you do when you were a beginner to learn? I mean, you didn't have your book, so what was it like early on for you?
You know, it was, gosh, I found a bunch of old deliverables, and I don't know that I was very good, but I don't know that anybody was back then. What I found out was in the late 90s and early aughts, I guess, I was doing design work. I was doing flash work, and I really wasn't a good visual designer. So I did my best to kind of start working in flash because I could see the interactions, I could organize content, and I could sit down in Photoshop and kind of fake my way through it. I mean, even old visual design that I've done has been an exercise in what we call gray boxing now, where it's just, here's a square with a color. and I kind of taught myself how to code. I am proud to say that I know some Cold Fusion. I've taught myself some ASP and some PHP and how to work in MySQL and Access just enough to be dangerous and just enough to maybe call bullshit when people say things can or can't be done. And so, you know, along those lines, that's kind of helped me understand how things work. Hell, I've built multi-user blog systems, with workflow that, you know, kind of goes along the editorial mindset. And anybody who's ever built even a simple blog, kind of starts to understand content management systems a lot better. And so being able to do that really helped me kind of find my way. The other thing that really helped me was the Information Architecture Institute. I found this mailing list, and it's that aha moment that a lot of people have where they say, oh, shit, I just found a whole bunch of other people like me. You know, it's kind of like when you realize there was a Dungeons and Dragons club at high school.
What are the defining traits of that club?
You know, I think it's can I pull out my book and read the little beginning part? But there's I like to solve problems. In fact, I think it was 2.5 years ago, Robert Hookman and I were at Voices That Matter in San Francisco, and I asked him, what does he tell people that he does for a living? And he said, user experience designer. And he returned the question, and I said, well, I'm a problem solver. And that's what I truly believe that I am. Hell, I don't know that there'll be a user experience design field in 10 years, to be honest with you. But I do know that we'll be solving problems. I do know that we'll be doing things like facilitating with our clients, be that through stakeholder interviews or workshops to get things done that aren't normally happening. In fact, let me ask you guys, do you have a business analyst in your company?
No.
When's the last time you worked with a business analyst?
Never.
Does that not scare the living shit out of you? Okay.
No.
Do you ask clients for requirements?
We work with them and we'll build them out.
Well, what are you using as requirements then? Bullets? And I'm being serious. This isn't like a I'm finger pointing to your company, but I'm curious because from where I've come from. In fact, even in the Guerrilla Research Methods workshop, we'll give 5 or 6 bullet points to somebody, and I'll ask people, like, when's the last time you've gotten this much from a client? And people kind of say, oh, and I'm, yeah, right. So don't bitch at me that I didn't give you enough to work on, that I didn't give you enough to go off of in this workshop. So I think that, in fact, I worked with somebody recently where I got about 6 business requirements, and I had to blow them out. And either, you know, you do something like a task analysis grid or something else, but you find a way to articulate these business requirements. And for a lot of people, that's most likely a sitemap and wireframes to some degree with either annotations or functional specifications. But from where I'm sitting, that business analyst stuff doesn't seem to be happening as much unless you're in a really large company or something with the word enterprise in it. Anyway, I think I just took us completely completely off track from your question. What was your question?
No, that's good. You know, it's been a challenge for us. I think the learning curve is that a lot of the clients, obviously, especially in a market like Des Moines, aren't as well educated in the process either. And so we've been lucky early on to work with some clients that have a background in building digital products, and they come in and the requirements list is very well fleshed out, very well thought out, and it makes a lot of sense, and we're able to poke and prod a little and make some work out of that. And on the other side, we get the 100,000 foot view, where there aren't even bullet points. It's a sentence, maybe it's two sentences of what it needs to be.
And then we start molding those into workflows and straight into wireframes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And that's where things have coalesced the most for us, is when we hit that wireframing stage. And, you know, I don't know if it's a perfect process. I don't know if it's the process we'll have 2 years from now, but, you know, getting to visualizing as quickly as possible has been working very well for us.
And I hear that that's happening a lot, but at the same time, there's folks who are working in prototypes. How do you guys handle that, or do you? I know this is your podcast, but come on.
No, this is good. Our interactive designer will actually, for her wireframes, they'll be clickable. They're not full prototypes.
So when you say they're clickable, do you mean, you know, she kind of does the map and slap, where she puts an image map on them and you click and go next?
Oh, no.
You said they're clickable. So then what tool are you using?
I'm trying to remember. I think Click Dummy is one she just went through.
I'm writing that down. I don't think I've ever heard of Click Dummy. This sounds interesting.
Yeah, it was pretty straightforward. She's been building lately. We tried out a couple of different tools, and lately she's just been gone back to building wireframes in Illustrator, because she just works the most rapidly in Illustrator, and kicks them out and then uploads, I think, either a PDF or a set of PNGs to the site, and then you kind of do the image mapping on top of it. You just, you know, grab a little box, draw it over a button, tell it where to go, link it to a couple of different pages, and
then everybody
people can leave
go
notes.
In.
Yeah, people can leave notes collaboratively.
Yeah, right on. That's
and,
awesome.
And such. So. No,
and I remember years ago on Flash beta lists and stuff, I remember asking Macromedia, saying, wow, you guys could, Macromedia, remember them? You guys could do some awesome stuff here with wireframes and click-throughs. It would be so cool if I could make a sitemap, click on it, see the screen, and then define the interaction. That would be so neat. And like, yeah, there's no audience for that back then, of course. Mm-hmm. No, and I think that's great, by the way. I think you guys were there when I was at Iowa UPA meeting last year in August, right? When I did that right way to wireframe, or, you know, looking behind the wireframe design process talk. So you know how I feel about this stuff. The tool is the right one you've got. I mean, if Excel works for you, kick ass, go do it. And, you know, Excel wireframe / prototype the hell out of whatever you got. And it's a communication tool. So, I think that's awesome. You know, Illustrator versus whatever it is, like I said, it's what works for you.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, you want people, if you're fighting the software, if you're fighting learning some new technique of just accomplishing a task, your brain's not going to be in it as much in the actual interaction design. And I think you get better results by working with something you're comfortable
Absolutely.
With.
Absolutely. And I think that's why there's not necessarily a standard anywhere. But
so you've got that new book you're working on, the Gorilla UX Research. I feel like that's aimed kind of squarely at folks like us that we're pretty small, yet we're trying to bring the notion of UX and UX research into what we do.
So I think it's directed toward just about anybody. Now, one of the things that that we talk about in the book, and I really push it hard in the workshop too, is that guerrilla research methods aren't by any stretch of the imagination a replacement for traditional research. These things generally are a little bit quicker. They require less rigor. In fact, Jared Spool calls what they look for at UIE the point of least astonishment. And that's where you get to the point in either testing or talking to users where you kind of can predict, you know, when what they're going to do, or what the mistake they're going to make, or whatever it is. So, you know, it focuses more on that, and and in fact, I've recently had a client where we've now done two different rounds of some remote usability testing. One round with an existing site, the most recent round with wireframes, and all of this has been done remote. And then once we get to the point with a live site, the client wants to go get behind the glass and do some, you know, I guess if you will, real or traditional research. So we definitely think of guerrilla research as a gateway drug. I mean, there's a it really is. I mean, the workshop that I did in Portugal, I had I only had 3 hours, but through using a technique we call the design studio, where it's a lot of rapid sketching. Generally, we say 6 to 8 ideas in 5 minutes, and we give you a handful of requirements at best, and it's go, go, go. You know, critique and pitch, or pitch and critique, using red and green pens to kind of tell people things that are good or that meet the requirements, and red for things that are encouraged to change, deltas, not negatives, right? We would never say anything negative. So using that sort of process, in about 3 hours, we had people taking one or two wireframes that they had sketched and walking out in the streets of Lisbon with a bag of candy, European candy, which is the great, by the way. I've got these, I've got like 7 videos online, running out into the street, which I didn't really think this through because I'm sending strange people out into the street with candy to talk to people. But they actually talk to real live users or real live people, and they're getting them to kind of point and click or tap on these hand-sketched, you know, wireframes or prototypes or whatever you want to call them. And if you think about this, you're testing against requirements. You're testing even potentially with real people. We did this in 3 hours. Certainly, we could have used a full day. But for a full day, you can knock out, in some cases, you know, weeks or at least days of work doing a lot of these things. You know, so it's a pretty good thing. And you can do these with real users. You can do these in kickoff meetings with your stakeholders. There's so many different ways that you can use these in the different intents. So, and that's just kind of talking about one technique. Obviously, there's remote research and testing. There's A/B testing. There's, gosh, you know, using crowdsourcing, or there's a method that myself and Brad Nunnally came up with called rapid iterative proto sketching. And I'm not going to go through that in full detail. It's a long one. But there's just a bunch of these things that you can do in a short amount of time. Again, it's not that these aren't quick and dirty. I mean, I can tell you I've busted my ass putting together some reports and stuff from this. And I know there's the quote-unquote lean UX methods that people are talking about, which is essentially kind of getting down to some of the basics. And you know, I think all of this is really good. It just has to be communicated clearly, again, the intent and purpose, so that your clients understand. I mean, you know, if you think about it, if you can get $1,000 from your boss and you can get a day or two worth of time, you can get a lot of information done if you know how to kind of work that. And if you can do that and have that point you in the right direction, in fact, one of the techniques that I talk to people about is, and this is by no means anything that I invented, this has been around forever, is to go to a coffee shop and ask somebody to take a look at your application or what have you. In fact, last year I was driving around to Starbucks in the Chicago area and meeting people to go over wireframes for a project for a client. If you can do that, you know, it's one of the things I told them is it doesn't matter that I work for a company called HappyCog or that I've written that book. That's not what allows me to do it. It's my absolute lack of caring whether or not I look like a fool. Which is very clear if you've attended me when I talk or am in a workshop. 5 minutes of feeling a little foolish versus, you know, rework that could take you 5 days. Yeah, which one's going to piss you off more in the end, and which one gives you a better story to tell? So I really like these. Like I said, I'm far from the inventor or creator of so many of these things, but they're good and they're useful. And again, it's that gateway drug. We, you know, I'm a big fan of doing real research, and I just haven't had as many opportunities as, for example, Todd Zaki-Werfel, who's my co-author and who's kind of come up in research. So to me, these things need to be out there. We all want more research. We all wish we had better requirements, and we all wish we could, you know, speak more to users. So let's find a couple of ways that, you know, go along that get us there. I mean, Steve Krug will tell you maybe even 3 people. We'll try to do 8 to 12, depending on who we're talking with and stuff. Anyway, I'm going off on the deep end on something that clearly I like and enjoy.
So that covers a lot of the what and the how on guerrilla research. Talk to me about the when. I mean, a day driving around the suburbs, you know, at Starbucks, getting people to look at your wireframes is still a day driving around the suburbs and you know, on a short timeline. How do you identify those moments when we've got to get some feedback on this?
Well, I mean, so this is one of those sort of, I don't know, that standard it depends type of thing, right? I mean, every situation is different. Every client is different. If you're going to use exact same process for every single client, you're probably going to get into a little bit of trouble with every single client. I'm all for, you know, saying we don't do waterfall or we do agile or whatever those things are that you want to do. But I believe that you have to assess every single client independently and differently, and understand what their needs are and talk with them. I mean, you know, if and there's some cases where you're going into a shitstorm knowing that it's that, and in some cases that may be your own fault, and in some cases that may be financially driven. I mean, I get it. We all have to eat. We have to keep our companies in business. So the reality is not everybody gets a perfect client every darn time. And when you've got companies out there that are, oh, this is how we do it, I like to say that I work in the real world and that you know, those things don't always happen. Almost, I've been in so few frictionless environments. I've had a couple of clients over the course of my career. I've been really lucky where they've just been fantastic. But as far as the when, just to get back to your question, the when is when you absolutely just, you need it. You don't have enough to go on, or you feel like you're constantly striking out and the client thinks you don't get it, or, you know, you're fearful you could even lose the client. You know, you have to look at that trade-off. One of the things that we'll say in the workshop too is sometimes it's not even worth asking your boss for the $25 to go talk to 5 people at Starbucks. Sometimes you just go spend it on your own because, again, it saves you 5 days later and you've got some data to work off of. And that usually helps. Now, if a client says to you, great, but it's only, you know, you've only got 5 pieces of data, then my response is, great, you gave me no budget for research. But this is what I found out. Do you want to spend more money on research? Would you like to actually have some information from real users? Or, you know, do you want to maybe take a chance that some of these questions that I asked and some of the results that we got are good feedback and point us in the right direction? It, you know, it kind of sucks because there's no great answer to this. And one of the other things that I've been telling people is that if you haven't noticed, the user experience space in the United States, at least, and it certainly seems like it's doing this in Europe a little bit, is exploding. There's very limited reason to sit yourself in a job in which you're miserable. There's not a lot of excuses for staying at a company that you don't feel like you're getting to do the work that you want to be able to do as a user experience person. One of the other things I like to tell people too, by the way, is to go into your boss on Monday and say, hey, what's my career path? And see if he shits his pants or not. Because a lot of people, you know, this UX thing is still pretty darn new. What is your career path? I know if I ask my boss, well, hi, Greg, he might he might be mad that I even said that. But I also, you know, I'm happy where I'm at and I like my role. And that's a big thing. So I'm less worried about it. But if you're worried about whether or not you get to become a senior person, then or if you're only going to be stuck in this area where, you know, you feel like you're doing production work and you're at the mercy of a development team or creative team or even clients who, for whatever reason, you know, won't let you either talk to them or talk to their users, then, you know, you should self-assess.
At the heart of it, isn't UX about the confluence of all of those coming together for the good of the user?
Maybe. I don't know. Have you ever received have you ever met a user on the street and have they ever given you $5 and said, hey, that was a great fucking app. Thanks, dude. Not okay, yet. So what it's really about is making money, right? It's finding that, yeah. that cross section of here's user experience and getting business requirements.
I mean getting the getting UX done well. Like if you do your job to the best of your ability, if you haven't talked to the developers, if you haven't talked to the designers, they can totally blow all of your work away or ignore it.
It depends on your environment. I mean, at Happy Cog, at least, we all talk to each other.
Well, yeah. But I'm saying that, like, for me, it feels like user experience as a discipline is getting people to talk about, getting designers, programmers, user experience folks all talking about this set of, I don't know.
Go ahead.
This meta feel good. No.
So what it is, right, is you've got a business goal you have to meet. I mean, these things are being done right. because one reason or another, be it through some Forrester report, a C-level person read about user experience and now they need it, which I'm not against. I think it's great. That serves a purpose. In fact, you know, you even see now Gary V is out there at Big Omaha telling people that the user experience designer people are the most important people in the room. The more there's advocates like that, the more that helps us. But the reality is, and we have to just be clear about this, is that there are business requirements and we are doing our best to make a user experience that also, you know, does the right thing for the users, but at the same time doesn't completely shut down what business goals are. I mean, let's face it, if we designed everything for the user, would there ever be ads on websites? I don't know that for sure, but I can tell you that there are certain websites out there owned by media properties where a certain 300x300 island ads are making $1 million a year. So if you've got to design around that eyesore by some people's perspective, you know, versus making that $1 million a year, which could be paying a bunch of salaries, what do you do? I mean, that's the challenge. It's the balance of all that. I don't believe that we are being, you know, completely purist about that. We're helping businesses, you know, by using things. We're helping businesses by building, you know, hopefully good user experiences through information architecture and content strategy. And you know, hopefully all of these things are coming together to get the right experience.
That's it for us today. Russ, I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to come and chat with us.
Not a problem. Maybe we'll catch you guys this weekend when I'm in Johnston, huh?
Sounds good. We're looking forward to it. Thanks,
all right,
man.
Take care. Thanks.